All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to Torah Studies. Let's explore the Torah portion of this week, which is Korach. Now, Korach presents fascinating intrigue, drama. You think you've seen everything. You've seen Adam and Eve and their sin. You've seen Noah and the flood. You've seen Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. You've seen Joseph. You've seen the Exodus. You've seen the splitting of the sea, the giving of the Torah. The sin of the golden calf, the building of the tabernacle, you've seen the sin of the spies. But today, we explore the mutiny, the attempted mutiny, and the attempted coup led by Moses' own cousin. His own cousin. With cousins like that, who needs, right? Led by his own cousin, Korach versus Moshe. The epic battle takes place in this week's Torah portion. So you can find the parasha in your Chumash, beginning with page, who's got it? 969. All right, here we go. But let's begin in a completely different place and talk about what are the different types, classifications of life on Earth as we know it. So, philosophers and scientists have posited that when you break down a kingdom classification of earthly terrestrial life, you can divide it into three different categories. Again, philosophers and scientists, I learned this in science class as a kid, it's my confession, that there are three kingdoms of life. Number one, help me out here.
Animal.
Well, starting from the bottom.
Mineral.
Yes, mineral. Right, so we have mineral, also known as inanimate life. Life that does not move. It's not animated, it doesn't grow, at least as far as we can see it. Right, it doesn't grow, it doesn't move, it doesn't think, it's just still. You put a rock there, it's going to sit there, it's doing its thing, it's inert, it's not moving. Water would also fall under the category, even though water flows in rivers and, you know, Niagara Falls, all that good stuff. Nonetheless, water is considered to be inanimate, it doesn't have its own, you know, self-animating vitality. So that's first category. Above that is, what do we have? Above that is vegetation, literally above the earthly stuff, stuff that doesn't move, vegetation. What does vegetation do? Help me out.
It grows.
What doesn't it do? It doesn't move. So the one above it literally is?
Animals,
birds, fish, things that can move, things that have the power of not only growing from big to small, but also the power to move and to roam their environs. We've talked about trees and fruit, right? We've talked about that lately. I feel like we did. Tu B'Shvat. Maybe in a different class I mentioned this. How fruit is a scam.
A scam.
It only exists because trees want to propagate the species. Trees want to have more trees. That's the nature, the biological nature that God implanted literally in trees, is that trees want to have more trees. They want to have more baby trees. The problem is, you can't have your kid grow up right next to you. It's awkward. It's not enough ground, not enough space for the roots. So how do you take your tree children and send them out of the house? It's hard when you don't have any arms. All you have are branches and they don't move in that way. So what do? So you develop a system where the seeds are encased in fruit and it's yummy. And so birds or animals or people will take it, carry it off somewhere else, eat it, discard it. Boom, mazel tov, you have a new tree growing in a new place away from mama tree or papa tree. Make sense? That's off topic. The point is like this. We have inanimate life. We have vegetation. Vegetation can grow, but it cannot move. And then you have animal, fish, bird, animal life, which can also move. It grows and it can move. Science ends there. And science says that human beings are part of which category?
Animal.
Right, human beings are an animal. Again, I learned this inside. I myself learned this in Pittsburgh Yeshiva, in our science class, that human beings are more sophisticated animals, but an animal nonetheless. What does Judaism say?
No.
Famously, Judaism says, no, human beings are not just an animal, but rather human beings are another category of existence. So you have inanimate, you have vegetation, you have animal, and then you have the human being. And it's another category altogether. It's not just a little bit more, a little bit less. It's a different category. The question is, what is at the heart of this debate? What is at the core of the debate? And why is it a big deal? So again, two questions. What is at the core of the debate, at the heart of the debate? Whether or not human beings are just animals that are more evolved or are a different category of life altogether. So what's at the core of that debate itself? And number two, who cares? Does it really change anything? So what, we're offended that we're called an animal? Who cares? I mean, does it really matter? Does it really take away from anything that we can do? So what is it? You say yes. Tell me why. How does it affect us? How does it affect you?
Okay, because the human can step out of himself and acknowledge the Creator, and the human.
But let's say I can. Fine, but let's say I can do that. So let's say I think I'm an animal, but I have a mind that can transcend itself. So what's the big deal?
But there isn't such an animal.
Say it again.
Is there such an animal that can transcend itself?
Let's call it the human animal. Like, is there a fundamental difference? It seems like, in other words, if the human being has a feature that is greater than other animals, does it matter if it's an animal with the feature or if it's something else altogether? And does the label actually matter? We'll see soon that it does. But we'll get there in a second. So now that we talked about Korach for a second. Then we got into a discussion about life on Earth, four or three categories. Now let's bring it back to Korach, which is seemingly unrelated to what we just interjected with. But as we'll see today, it is totally related. Today we're going to explore some incredible questions, topics, questions in the story of Korach and Korach's attempt at mutiny. We're going to discover a Talmudic passage from the Jerusalem Talmud, from the Talmud Yerushalmi, that sheds a lot of light on what was the beef between Korach and Moshe. And then we're going to explore an explanation given by the Rugachever Gaon, the famous Gaon of Rugachever, who explains what was at the core of the debate as understood by the Talmud and other commentaries. You should know that the story is that, at least what I believe to be true and what I've heard to be true, is that the Rebbe got his smicha, his rabbinic ordination, from the Rugachever Gaon. So he actually got rabbinic ordination. So he was a very, very incredible, very bright rabbi. He was the one who didn't, I mentioned it before, he didn't cut his hair. He was a Nazir, like Samson we had a few weeks ago. He didn't cut his hair. And rumor has it that it was actually painful for him if he would attempt to cut his hair. So that's just what they say about the Rugachever Gaon. But we'll get there soon. Let's reset the story of Korach. Page 969, your Chumashim, please open up. So the Torah portion begins by introducing who Korach was. Ray, please get us started. 969, chapter 16, book of Numbers.
Korach, the son of Yizhar, the son of Kehos, who was the son of Levi, took issue with Moshe. He was joined by Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and An, the son of Peleth, Reuven's descendant. They confronted Moshe together with 250 men from the children of Israel, leaders of the congregation, representatives of the assembly, men of repute. They ganged up on Moshe and Aharon and said to them, "You've made yourselves too important, for the entire congregation are all holy, witnesses to the revelation at Sinai, and God is with them. So why have you made yourselves elite over God's assembly by appointing Aharon as the priest?" When Moshe heard this, he fell on his face.
Let's pause here for a second. So who was Korach? Who was he?
He was a cousin.
He's the son of Yitzhar, the son of Kahas. Kahas had three sons. His grandfather was Kahas. Kahas had three sons. I'm sorry. Kahas had, I think, four sons, but Kahas is one of the three sons of Levi. But be that as it may, Korach's father, Yitzhar, his brother was Amram. Who was Amram? Moshe's dad. So Moshe's father and Korach's father were brothers. So they were cousins. They were first cousins. Their fathers were brothers. Korach joins together, bands together. He was the leader. He brings together a few others, Dathan, Aviram, they're famous antagonists of Moshe, On ben Peleth, On the son of Peleth, and 250 men of repute. leaders of the congregation, not ill repute. Usually repute goes with ill, right? Ill repute, one of those things. But repute, these are people of actual repute. Who would have thought? They were kosher at some point. Repute is substance. That's not good substance. Repute, I guess, is... Yeah, anyway, they were obviously doing a negative thing as the story unfolds, but nonetheless, they were chashav. They were they had some importance to them. And they gang up on Moshe, and the core of the ganging up is where they say, Madu tisnasu al kahal Hashem. Why do you lift yourselves up? Why do you consider yourselves elite over the congregation of Hashem? They evoke God. God's congregation. Who made you so important? Moshe and Aaron. How did this happen? Moshe falls on his face. The story unfolds. We're not going to get into it inside because we're analyzing another part of the story. But the story unfolds just to kind of round out the narrative. Moshe basically advises them that he's going to set up a challenge, if you will, of who's right and who's wrong in this situation. He has the 250 men on the other side bring fire pan offerings. He brings a fire pan offering. And what happens next?
Aaron's sons
bring it, right? Both you and Aaron should take a fire pan. They took fire pans, fiery coals, and they placed incense on it. And at some point, the earth opens up. Right, Moshe says, if we're right and they're wrong, let their death happen not in the way of usual people, not in the normal way of happening. And indeed, the earth opens up and swallows alive Korach and his followers, and they're gone forever. So that's how the story ends.
What about Aaron's two sons, don't they?
That happened before. Aaron had four sons. Yeah. Aaron had four sons. So these were the other two that remained. His two had passed away the day of the inauguration of the Mishkan, which was a little bit before this. Now, a few questions come to mind. Clearly what's happening here is a challenge of leadership from Korach to Moshe and to Aaron. So question number one, and it's an obvious question. Why is this happening now? When did Moshe become the leader?
Way back.
I mean, it's like a year or two. It's not, I mean, for us, it's way, but it was definitely not just now. It happened already in Egypt. So if you had an issue with Moshe's leadership, the question is, why does he wait until now? Aaron had been appointed the high priest already when they were building the tabernacle. There was a discussion about which garments to make for the priests, for the high priest. Why now? What's happening now that suddenly Korach is like, hey, wait a second, let's take another vote here. I don't like the way this is playing out. I think I should be in charge. Like, why is this playing out right now? Commentaries explain a few different things. So, before I tell you what some commentaries say, anybody have any...
Is this right after the spies?
This is right after the spies, yeah.
And then all these people start dying, that generation starts dying out. So maybe you could think that this is too severe, this is too awful.
I like what you're saying. So, commentaries say, along the lines of what you're saying, that after the sin of the spies, and the Jews now get the decree, they're not entering the land for another 40 years. So now there's a disgruntled, in general, people are disgruntled and disheartened. So now is as good time as any, you know, when the polls are low, right, when the poll numbers are low, now it's time to challenge authority. When everyone's riding high, there's a tabernacle, or even when things were not good, but Moshe was gaining forgiveness, for example, for the golden calf, now... That's not a good time to challenge authority. But once things are not looking so good, right? Now Moshe's not leading them into the land of Israel. He may never lead them into the land of Israel himself, and he doesn't. Right? So now maybe they can challenge his authority. So that's one idea. Another idea is that another relative had been appointed. What was his name? I forgot his name already. Another relative of Korach's had been appointed to a tribal leader, to a position of tribal leadership. And Korach felt like this was a personal snub, like he had been, you know, passed over for this honor of leader of the tribe. And so at this point he said, that's it. I'm going to take it out full, you know, he's going to go with his full fury and try to completely dethrone this Moshe Aaron leadership contingency. Fine. So whatever, yeah.
Korach, though, he was a Levite, though, right?
He was a Levite.
He
had his own gig.
He had his own gig.
And yet, he wanted more. Okay, so the question as far... So to answer the question of why now, again, either because you know, the times are challenging, or because he had been just personally, he felt he had been personally snubbed for a position of honor, for an additional position of honor, in addition to being a Levite. The question, though, is, what exactly was the issue that he had? In other words, what was the issue with Moshe and Aaron? On a very simple level, the understanding is, he didn't really have an issue with them, it's just he wanted to be them. Right? It's not like they were not doing a good job, it's that, you know, he wanted to be in charge, and they were in charge, and he's trying to simply be in charge. Like any power play, politics type move, where somebody's in charge, you don't like them because they're in charge, so you want to throw them out so that you get in charge. Right? This happens in boards, it happens in companies, it happens in politics, in countries, it happens on city level, it happens in schools, it happens everywhere, where, right, there's leadership and overthrowing of leadership and usurping of leadership, and that's the way it is. So on a simple level, we can understand the story as Korach simply wanting the leadership of Moshe and Aaron. Correct? Yes? Okay. Good. That's the setup. Now we need to study the Talmud. Open up your Torah Studies booklets to the appropriate page, which we'll discover in a moment. All right, the appropriate page is text number 4. I do. I have a few extra. But first, before we do text number 4, let's do text number 3. Please pass down. Oh, you have more copies than you know what to do with at this point. Look at that. Okay, text number... Jillian, please read text number 3. You want to pass? Okay, it's a one line. Okay, Karen, please read text number 3.
Number 3.
2:10.
If Korach was so wise, how was he open to such foolishness?
This is the question. The Midrash says, this is before the Talmud. We'll get to text 4 in just a second. But first, to set the Talmudic statement up in text 4, the Midrash says... He was a smart guy. What was he doing? Such a foolish thing. He thought he was really going to best Moshe and Aaron? He thought he was really going to win? Come on. What was he thinking? Was it really just about power? It seems very foolish. It seems like there must be something deeper at play here. The Midrash says, if he was so smart, how could he do something so foolish? There has to be a deeper agenda, more than just wanting to overthrow power and gain power. Power blinds people and it corrupts people, without a doubt. And the pursuit of power can turn people into monsters. That's true. But there has to be something more. Text number 4 provides a clue. Sarah, text 4, Jerusalem Talmud, page 2:10.
Moshe replied, "It does require them, as the verse says, you shall make strings." Korach then asked Moshe whether a house full of holy scrolls requires a mezuzah. Moshe replied, "It does, as the verse states, write it upon the doorpost." He then asked what the law states regarding Baharat.
It's a sign. It's one of the signs of Sarat, the biblical form of leprosy. So it's like a white splotch or a white patch on the skin.
The size of a bean. Moshe replied, "It is impure." Korach asked the law regarding a baharat that spread to cover the entire body. Moshe replied, "It is pure." Korach said at that moment, "The Torah is not from heaven. Moshe is not a prophet, and Aaron is not a high priest."
Does this sound like a power play? Solely a power move here? There's some questions here. Now, one could say that this is a cover for his true intentions. Like, he really just wants power. But in order to get power, so he pretends like he couches it in some religious questions and, you know, some sort of philosophical or theological debate. One could say that. But let's take the Talmud text at face value. What is Korach? How is Korach challenging Moshe? What's he saying? He's challenging him in areas of Jewish law. Three specific areas. What's the first area of Jewish law? regarding the laws of tzitzit. So let's reset this whole discussion. The Torah says that when you wear a four-cornered garment, you should put tassels, strings, tzitzit at the sides. So, this will be my, if I can get it, this will be my four-cornered garment, right? One, two, three, four, right? Four corners. Imagine there's a hole right in the middle, and I put it on, right? So lovely. So I would need to put strings on the side. If you're wearing a poncho, right? You know, like a poncho? Mm-hmm. But like a real poncho from south of the border, right? Like a real poncho. And it's made, right? You put it on, it goes like, right? It's like a thing. And it's made with corners. According to Jewish law, you have to string it with tzitzis. Yeah. A four-cornered garment has to have tassels. Why? Go figure. Now, if any of the corners are rounded, or if they're sewn, if they're stitched together and it's not four, then you don't need the tassels. By the way, if you're not planning on wearing a four-cornered garment, if you're planning on wearing a regular shirt or whatever it is, so you have no mitzvah to wear tzitzit. Nonetheless, since it's a biblical commandment, so people go out of their way to wear a four-cornered garment to have the mitzvah. So whether we wear it under our garments, the talit katan, the small talit with the tzitzis, which many wear underneath the shirt, or whether we wear it in services with a larger prayer shawl, either way, we make an effort to specifically do the mitzvah, even though theoretically it only applies when you happen to be wearing a four-cornered garment, make sure there are tassels. So his and the biblical commandment is that in the tassel, in the strings, you should have the tchelet, which is a blue-colored dye in the strings. A big fish or a small snail. The problem is we don't know exactly where. Okay. So that's why we don't really do it. Some have a tradition or say that they rediscover the tradition of what type of creature it comes from, and they have it today, so you can actually buy tzitzit with tchelet. We had a class a few years ago about this. Do we know it? Do we not know it? It's up for debate, so at least the Chabad custom is not necessarily to do it.
It's pretty compelling.
That what it is or it's not? This might have been before your time.
Yeah, I wasn't here for that, but
no, you weren't.
There was a secondary indigo dye that looks almost the same.
Yeah.
One of the things about this truculous dye, the wavelength is 613.
Interesting. So is it, it's in that,
it's different.
Yeah. So here's the thing. We had a class on it and we cited the various opinions about what it is. The conclusion was it's not 100% conclusive, and therefore some say, listen, once when Mashiach comes, we know for sure, then we know for sure. Until then, we'll just play it safe. Either way, so Korach says, yeah.
It's not the thing that when the Mashiach comes and everyone comes.
No, that's the Leviathan. That's the Leviathan. That's going to be sushi.
What, yeah. What do you mean by play it safe?
So since it's not definitive, what is the creature that produces the blue dye, so therefore Chabad and others have the custom to not introduce any blue dye into the talit, as long as it's not conclusively known. So we don't gamble and say, well, we think it's this, or even 99% sure if there's still 1% chance that it's not. So again, but again, it's not. It's if somebody has it or somebody wants to have it, it's fine. I'm just saying what Chabad custom is without that certainty. So Chabad talisim and talits do not have that now. The overall point is that Korach is saying, what if the entire garment of four corners is made out of the blue? His assumption is, you know, if you have a white garment, so you need a little bit blue to show, whatever the reason is, you need some blue in there. But what if the whole thing is blue? Do you need tassels? For sure not. Moshe says yes. Korach says, ugh. All right, then he says, okay, what about a house that's filled with Torah scrolls? Everywhere you look at the Torah scroll with the book of Deuteronomy with the Shema in it. Do you need a mezuzah on the door? If you have a room that has nothing, you have a kitchen, you have kitchen appliances, you have a KitchenAid, and a Frigidaire, right? You have all these things, and an icebox, right? As we spoke about last time, right? With a delivery of the milk, right? If you have all these things, so then you need the Shema, you need some Jewish mention. But what if the whole house, or what if the whole room is filled with Torah scrolls? Do you need a mezuzah also? You need 100 scrolls and a little one? Of course not. What does Moshe say? You do. Okay. He's like, And if someone has a little blotch of white, they're impure. What if the whole skin is covered with the blotch? For sure impure, right? Pure. He's like, that's it. Moshe's out, Aaron's out, the Torah's out. That's it, we're out. That's what the Talmud says, the Jerusalem Talmud says. What's going on here? Is it just a question about Jewish law? Is it a debate about Jewish law? If it's a debate about Jewish law, so then why is Korach called a heretic? And why does Korach reject, if it's just an issue of Jewish law, why does he reject the Torah not being from Torah is not from heaven, Moshe is not a prophet, Aaron is not the high priest? Seems like it escalates from a disagreement about Jewish law. Seems like it really escalates into him being called a heretic and denouncing the entire thing. What's going on here? To understand this better, we're going to look at an insight from Rabbi Yosef Rosen, the Ragachover Gaon, who I mentioned before. The Ragachover explains that at the core, and listen carefully, at the core of Korach's issue with Moshe and Aaron, at the core of all three of these items, the talis that's blue, and the house that's full of scrolls, and the skin that's totally white, at the core of all of this, and his debate, it gets back to one core idea. In other words, there's one thing that Korach is debating with Moshe. There's one core point, and that expresses itself in the power play and in the specific areas of Jewish law that we just mentioned. And it gets down to a matter of heresy ultimately. So let's explore this. What's at the core? At the core is what I like to call the great debate about the cell phone feature. You remember BlackBerry back in the day?
Yes.
Remember the BlackBerry? Mm-hmm. Everyone had a BlackBerry. Not everyone, but many people had BlackBerries. BlackBerries were in. Yeah. Anybody here have a BlackBerry back in the day? Yes? Some people still miss them, yeah. Give me a real keyboard, yeah. My brother-in-law has a BlackBerry. He's into it still. Okay. So if you recall, this is going back a number of years. If you recall, so BlackBerry had so they were very much focused on business solutions. Their email was encrypted, very tight security on their devices, and they were all about business. And because of that, some of their phones did not have a camera for two reasons. Number one, what do you need a camera when you're working? Like, who needs a camera? It's not like you're not doing a photo op of your family. It's a business line. It's a business phone, business device. Number two, when you're in a sensitive place, having sensitive meetings, the presence of a camera can compromise the security of the surroundings. Yes? Even if there's a sign that says no photography, if you have a camera on the phone, you never know when someone's going to slip a picture in. But if the phone doesn't even have, if the device doesn't even have a camera, it makes it a little bit easier. You should know, by the way, they've looked at pictures of Mark Zuckerberg's computer. You know, the Facebook guy? Mm-hmm. He has black electrical tape over his webcam camera. Have you ever seen pictures of that? He takes, you do too, yeah. He takes his security probably more seriously than billions of his users. But the point is that you have a camera. If there's a camera around, there could be trouble. So BlackBerry would make their devices, many of their devices, without a camera. Again, what do you need a camera for? And you don't want a camera in certain business-sensitive, secure situations. Government, right? BlackBerry had government contracts and everything. But they had good devices. And people, many people wanted to get in on it because you don't have to be in a government position or in a sensitive business position to enjoy a BlackBerry. So they rolled out more and more consumer devices. Some were different and some were the same. And there were certain models of BlackBerry where you could get one either with a camera or without the camera. So the same exact phone, one had the camera and one didn't have the camera. So let me ask you this question. You have them side by side, two phones, two devices, identical. The only distinction is this one does not have a camera and this one has a camera. What is the difference between them?
One is trustworthy and the other is not.
Good. Good, good, good. Trustworthy. You're saying very simply, Ray, one has a camera, one doesn't. Price.
The camera one's going to cost a lot more.
You would think, right? Or maybe business will pay more to make sure there's no camera, right? It's kind of like how like whole wheat flour is more than, I'm not an expert in food product manufacturing, but sometimes the more natural stuff today is even more expensive. They did less to process it, and they'll charge you more for it just because it's more coveted. So who knows, supply and demand makes things a little weird. The point is, on a very basic level, the difference is a camera. Would you say that fundamentally the device has become a new a different device with the addition of the camera? In other words, would you say that the other features of the phone are fundamentally altered and changed because of the presence of a camera? Or is everything else the same, just you have a camera? Understand the question? It's almost a philosophical question. When you have two things that are similar, except that one has a certain feature or an aspect that the other one doesn't, does that mean that the two are essentially the same, just this one has a little bit more of something or something that that one doesn't have? Or do you say that that little thing that it has renders it in a completely different category than the other item? Are you with me on the question? It's a chakira, two ways to look at it. Chakira is a Talmudic and yeshivish word that means when you're choker, there's two ways to look at it. Do you say that it's the same, just plus one? Or do you say that the plus one makes it fundamentally different, and that everything that and that transforms and makes it so that everything is different than the other one? That's the question. That's the chakira. You're probably thinking, who really cares? You'll see soon how this changes everything and is at the heart of heresy versus belief. Yeah.
It sounds kind of similar to the. Do you remember the thing on Shavuot, the two definitions of reinvention? So one is basically where you have the same thing, you haven't really transformed the initial item. It's like, for an example, reinventing the wheel,
Right.
And the other is taking something and then modifying it to where it becomes something
completely different. Right. So the question is, what makes something new or in a different category, completely new and different category? Does the presence of this feature, that feature, this additional thing, does it transform it or not? So with that in mind, let's read text number 5. Okay, Marnine, are we up to you? 212? Here's the Ragachavar going explaining what was at the core of Korach's mutiny.
Korach's claim was primarily defined by a philosophical question: when a greater and lesser entity both share a common quality, is the greater entity still greater even in the quality they share? This was Korach's departure from Moshe and the Torah, and it is implied by his words. Why do you place yourself above them? Korach claimed that in those things he shared with Moshe and Aaron, they were essentially equal, and this claim reflects all questions of whether a common denominator between unequal parties are truly equal.
What's clear is that the superior qualities of the superior thing are superior, because that's a superior quality. The question is, when you have two entities, items, people, but they share a lot, but there's some differences, in what they share, are they the same? Or is the greater one greater even in the qualities that they share? Make sense? I'm jumping ahead because I want to present something else and then bring it back to Korach against Moshe and Aaron. But let's just do it now, just so that it's clear. What was Korach saying about Moshe and Aaron? Let's talk about Moshe for a second. Korach acknowledged that Moshe had certain gifts and had certain communications, divine communication, had certain amazing, realities that were bestowed upon him, that was certain. The question is something else. He and Korach and Moshe and the people, everyone share many commonalities. They both put on the same pair of tefillin. I mean, not maybe the same exact pair, but the same mitzvah. They're both putting on tefillin. They're both giving tzedakah. They're both observing Shabbat. It's the same stuff. At the core, it's the same. Most things of Moshe and the people are the same. Moshe happens to also be a prophet and communicate with God and effect miracles and all that stuff. But at the core, there's a lot of commonality and common denominators between them. The question is, in that which is common or are they uncommon? Right? In the qualities that they share, when a greater and lesser entity both share a common quality, is the greater entity still greater even in the quality that they do share? Or do we say they're only greater in the greater quality, but in the stuff that they share, it's the same? You with me? In other words, yes, makes sense? Can Korach say, not can, Korach says, Moshe, yeah, he's got his qualities, but we're all the congregation of God. Moshe and me and Yankel the woodchopper, we're all the same. We're all, at the core, we're all the same. Moshe has this quality, this guy has that quality. Everyone has a little bit of, you know, tweaks here and there. But at the core, we're all the same. Or do we say, the rebuttal to Korach is, the fact that Moshe has these superior qualities means that everything about him is fundamentally and qualitatively different. So it's almost like this, it's not exactly this question, but it's almost like this question. It's a little bit misleading the way I'm going to phrase it, but maybe it'll help, you know, kind of quantify it a little bit. It's the question of quality versus quantity. Do we say that essentially they're the same quality, just this guy has this quantity or this extra feature or that extra feature, but the quality, the core quality is the same? Or do we say that the fact that Moshe, Aaron have these special features to them, so to speak, they have the camera, so they're fundamentally elevated, qualitatively different than everyone else? That was the core question. That was the core issue. Sure.
There's also that their heritage is the same.
It's common, exactly. And I would say their mission was also similar. Think about it this way. Korach was a Levite. Korach was a Levi. And he also served in the Levites served together with the priests. The priests did the sacrificial service. The Levites watched and sang. Who's better? They're each doing different things. Yeah, there's certain things that a Levite can't do, that a Kohen can do. There are certain things that a Kohen can't do that a Kohen Gadol, a high priest, can do. But does that mean that they're fundamentally, qualitatively different and more advanced? Are they superior in every way? Maybe not. Korach said, Madua tisnasu al kal Hashem. Why do you consider yourselves elevated beyond the people? Yes, there are certain things that only you can do, but that doesn't make you fundamentally different or greater than us. That's just something else that you can do. So what? At the core, there's commonality. Okay. To understand this, is this making sense a little bit? Yes? Okay. To understand this, let's look at another area of Jewish law that is absolutely fascinating. You'll have to halakha for this. I'm giving you the advanced disclaimer. It's a little bit intricate in the understanding of this concept, but I think it's very fascinating. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to do. So text number 6. Steve, please read this from the Talmud tractate Gittin. Before you start, I need to explain. What we call Chumash today, this we call this a Chumash. Back in Talmudic times, this is not what the word Chumash meant. Chumash meant a scroll, like a Torah scroll. The difference between a Sefer Torah and a Chumash in those times was not the difference between a parchment scroll with ink, with black ink, versus a bound book. That's not what the difference was. A chumash was a scroll that only had one of the books of the Torah. So it's kind of like the travel version, right? If you buy like, it's a smaller, more transportable version. So it's what?
It's the five volume set
as opposed to the all-in-one. So I'm giving you the terminology because you're going to have to know it to read text 6. So a Torah scroll back then meant like this, all five books in one, stitched together in one scrolled document or item. Chumash meant a scroll with one of the books of the Torah, one of the five. Text number 60.
The Galileans sent a question to Rabbi Helbo. Is it permissible to use an individual Chumash scroll for the public Torah reading in the synagogue?
The question makes sense? Yes? We're reading the book of Numbers. Do you need to pull out the whole five books? Someone's going to say, hey, can we read Genesis? It's not like... it's not a request line here. We're not taking, shout outs and, hey, can you play Noach by, So if we're in the book of Numbers, so just pull out the scroll for the Numbers. Okay, continue.
Rabbi Holdo did not know what to answer. The question reached Rabbi Yitzhak Nafcha, and he too did not know what to answer. He asked the question to the Bet Midrash, the House of Learning, and they found the answer in light of what Rabbi Shmuel or Nechmai said in the name of Rabbi Yochanan. One may not read from a Torah scroll missing even one panel of parchment. So how can one read from a single Chumash, which is missing four books of the Torah?
Stop here for a second, Understand the logic? It's answering it in the form of a rhetorical question, obviously, because it's the Jewish study hall. Nonetheless, let's explain what the first answer of the Talmud is. The question on the table is, can you pull out a single volume scroll, Book of Numbers, this Shabbat, and read Korach, read this portion? No one knows the answer. A few people don't know the answer. They raise in the Beit Medrash, and they say the following. If you had a full Torah scroll, and it's missing even one panel, it's not kosher. You can't read it. So how could you think that you can read a scroll that's missing four entire books? If even one panel... three columns. It's like a part of a part of a part of a book. If even one piece is missing, it's not kosher. You can't read it in the public setting. How can you read a scroll that's missing four whole books? Do we like this answer? Do you agree with this? Or you're like, it doesn't make sense?
I like it.
You like it? Let's continue. The Talmud continues.
Comments to the Talmud. The cases are not comparable. In the case of a Torah scroll missing a sheet of parchment, the Torah is incomplete. Rashi, it is called a Sefer Torah and is lacking. In the case of a single Chumash, it is perfect and lacking nothing.
The Talmud offers a rebuttal. And the Talmud says, I don't think so. Not a good answer. You're comparing apples to oranges. When it comes to the Sefer Torah, if it's missing one section of the parchment, it's lacking. It's missing. It's supposed to be a Sefer Torah, and it's not a Sefer Torah. It's not kosher. It's supposed to be all five books. That's what it is purportedly, right? It's saying, hey, look at me, I'm a Torah scroll, I'm a Sefer Torah, all five books are here, and they're not. It's not kosher. But if you have a single Chumash, it says, all I am is a Chumash, and it's complete, so maybe it's kosher. You don't like it. Why? You're saying, bottom line, it's missing. But how do you know? The question is, how do we know? So the first argument is because it has all five books have to be whole, have to be there in front of the reader. How do you know? Because if you have a scroll missing even one piece, it's not kosher, which means you have to have all five books in front of you. The Talmud says, not so fast. Maybe that's only the case in a Torah scroll, but not in a Chumash. If the Torah scroll is missing, it's no good. A Chumash that's whole, maybe it is good. So hold on one second, because what I want to say is that this dispute or this... The first answer of the Talmud, and then the rebuttal of that answer, it goes back to our same dispute. Korach and Moshe, the same dispute, the blackberries, it's the same question. When something has an additional feature, is it the same thing as the other thing, plus one or four? Or is it a new entity? The answer of the Talmud, the first attempted answer of the Talmud says, same thing. Same thing. Chumash, a Sefer Torah, it's all the same thing. They're all scrolls. So that's why the Talmud says we can answer the question about the Chumash from the Torah scroll, right? Because they're essentially the same thing. So a Chumash and a Torah scroll are the same thing. A Chumash has one book, a Torah scroll, a Sefer Torah has five books. But essentially, at its core, a Torah scroll and a Chumash are the same thing. They're scrolls. This one has one, this one has five. Right? 1 and 5. Therefore, the Talmud says, if this one is missing and doesn't have all five, it's no good. So this one also has all five, and it also has to have all five. And if it doesn't, it's also no good. To which the Talmud answers or rebuts that and says, not so fast. Who says that a Torah scroll, a Sefer Torah, is the same as a Chumash? A Sefer Torah is a fundamentally different item. And that's why it's not kosher. It's not kosher because it's a different item and it's no longer that item. It's not just a Chumash plus four. It's a Sefer Torah which has five books. And that has to have all five books to be a Sefer Torah. And if it doesn't, it's missing. But this Chumash, which is a lower level, it's complete. The question is not, is a Sefer Torah kosher missing parchment? Of course it's not kosher. The question is a lower level degree of holy ritual scroll, ayah chumash, is that level of sanctity sufficient to read on Shabbat services? That's the question. And the Talmud says, therefore, you can't bring me a proof from a scroll that's missing pieces to a chumash. You with me? Because there are two separate items. At the core, it comes back to the same question. At the core, it comes back to the question, you have a Chumash with one of the five books, and you have a Torah scroll with all five books. Are they the same? Because at the core, they're all Torah writings. Or do we say that the fact that the Sefer Torah has all five books, not just one, but all five, puts it in a qualitatively different category? The first answer of the Talmud seems to put it in the same category. They're both blackberries. One has a camera, one doesn't, but at the core, it's the same stuff. It's just one extra feature, either missing or left, right? So a few extra books, but it's the same core. So therefore, the Talmud says, we can learn from one to the other. If this is not kosher without everything, this is not kosher without everything. To which the Talmud says, no. No, it's not comparable. It's not comparable. You have one scroll which only has one book, and the other one has five. The Sefer Torah is a completely different category. It's apples to oranges. And that Sefer Torah is not complete without all five books. The Chumash is not a Sefer Torah, it's a Chumash. It's kosher with only one book. The question is, if it's holy enough, with its lower level sanctity, to be read on Shabbat. The point is, at the core of the debate between the answer and the rebuttal of the Talmud, is the question that the Ragachavra says is at the heart of the debate between Korach and Moshe. So here we go, text number 7. Let's bring it back. Dan, please read this one, page 214. This is again the Ragachavra.
So what's the disagreement?
What's that? Yeah.
The disagreement between Korach and Moshe is over whether the greater has an advantage over the lesser, even in their shared common denominator. The Talmud speaks at great length on this matter in various areas. See Gittin 60A.
And if you're wondering what Gittin 60A is, it's the discussion we just read about the scrolls, about the Chumash versus the Torah scroll. Are you allowed to read the scroll? You're wondering what you can. So what's the bottom line? Are you allowed to read or not? For that, we have to explore further. I'm not sure. I don't remember what the conclusion is in Jewish law. The point is like this: the Ragachavra says that the debate between Korach and Moshe is like this. Korach says we are fundamentally equal. You happen to have an extra feature, an extra quality, an extra prophecy, an extra miracle, fine. But at the core, we're the same. We're all blackberries, right? You have a camera, I don't have a camera, fine, so you can take pictures and I can't. Same blackberry. Madua tisnasu akal Hashem. Why are you raising yourself? Why are you elevating yourselves above the people? You're so much greater. Kulam kadoshim, everyone's holy. We're all holy. We're all blackberries. And what does Moshe say? It's not true. It's not true. Because because that extra quality fundamentally shifts everything else. You know what this debate is related to, another debate? What debate is this related to? The one that we started the class with. Are human beings animals? In the category of animals, or are they a different creature altogether? Same question. What would Korach say? Korach is the one that says a feature is a feature, but the commonality is commonality. What would Korach say? Are human beings different or are they animals? Animals. They're animals with a camera. They're animals with intelligence. Same thing. Same core stuff. Oh, and by the way, the difference between Korach and Moshe is not just semantics. It's whether you look at the shared qualities as being equivalent or being fundamentally different, even when they look the same. That's a distinction. Korach would say like this. Human beings are basically animals with a little bit more intelligence. Therefore, in the area of intelligence, they're superior. But in other areas, they are the same. So when it comes to eating and drinking, we eat and drink. And animals, yeah. We protect our young, and animals, yeah. We need shelter, they need shelter. We need rest, they need rest, right? We need something to do with our time, they need something to do with our time, with their time. So at the core, what Korach is saying is that human beings and animals, pretty much the same. Yeah, we have a mind, intelligence, and that maybe creates a distinction you can take. So fine, obviously you can take a picture, you have a camera. You have the camera. It's not like you don't have a camera. Everyone acknowledges, Korach also acknowledges, you have a camera, you have a mind, you have prophecy. Yeah, that's true. So in that area, you're different. But in all of the other areas, you're the same. Human beings are animals with an additional feature. That's what Korach says. What would Moshe say? The intelligence fundamentally shifts the entire being. And it's no longer an animal plus intelligence. It's not an evolutionary experience. It's a revolutionary experience, right? It's a completely different entity. It's not just an animal that eats and drinks and sleeps and shelters and all that stuff and protects. Plus intelligence, even those areas are shifted. Those areas are also fundamentally different. Let's take a look. Let's take a look at text number 10. Yeah.
I just want to ask a question, going back to text 6, though.
Yes.
Wasn't that exactly what this Talmud is saying, even though it ends with the fact that it is perfect and lacking nothing?
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it, it's not diminishing the perfection of the Chumash, because the Chumash is a Chumash is exactly what it is, a Chumash. But it is stating here that the Torah is not Chumash.
Correct.
And so therefore, the Chumash is not worthy of being read at Shabbat because.
No. The question. So no, I understand what you're saying. But the core question is that at the end, what you just said, right. Since it's not a Torah, so therefore it can't be read. That's the question. I mean, you're answering it, but what I'm saying is that's the question of the Talmud.
Yeah.
That Talmud doesn't answer that. In other words, how do you know what level sanctity scroll you need to read the Torah reading?
Okay, so
do you need the Chumash level, or do you need to go all the way up to that level? The rebuttal, though, says these are two different things. So therefore, each one has to be judged in its own world. You can't compare the two and say, well, this one's missing, so therefore they're both no good. It's two different worlds. There's the world of Chumash, and in the world of Chumash, Chumash is complete. And then you have a different world, the world of Torah, and the Torah is incomplete. So the incompleteness of Torah renders the Torah not good. But the Chumash is a different category, and the Chumash is kosher. Now the question is, once we know it's a kosher Chumash, is it kosher to read it for the service? That hasn't been answered. But the point is, this rebuttal, though, in concept, doesn't get rebutted. In other words, the concept of distinguishing between this and that, and saying, don't tell me that, well, if a Torah is missing pieces, no good, so a Chumash, which is by definition missing pieces, is also no good, that means you're equivalent, drawing an equivalency.
They're different.
Yeah. Now the question is, does distinction render it no good to read, or do we say, you know what, it's different, but it's also okay? That we have an answer. Now, Sandrine's question is, no, what's the answer?
Yeah.
And I don't know. We'll have to look it up.
The point is, though, is that
it's different.
That Moshe is different.
Oh, so let's read that inside right now. And please read text number 13, page 220. 217, text number 10. Sorry, text 10, 217.
Why do you raise yourself above them? Why, asked Corinth, does every Jew need to receive direction from Moshe, even in the common denominator?
In other words, when it comes to like special features, if you need a camera, you go to the camera. If you need a window and insight into divine prophecy and divine communication, you need Moshe. But how does Moshe excel in other areas that we all have, we all share equally? In other words, everyone's the same according to Korach. Moshe has an additional feature, but fundamentally everyone's the same. That's Korach's philosophy. What is Moshe's philosophy? Not true. I mean, it's really Torah's philosophy. It's not true. It's not just the same plus, it's fundamentally different. And again, this also affects the way we look at the classification of human versus animal life. Text number 12. Alex, please read this one. This is again from the Ragachover, and I love the way he phrases it. He's very cryptic. He was so smart, such a genius. His books are hard to read, but you'll see text 12 what he's saying.
The text 12.
Okay. Yep.
The argument between Korach and Moses hinges on whether the flesh of a donkey or another animal is similar to that of a human. That is, whether the animal life of a human is identical to that of a beast, except for his intellect, whether he is different even in bodily matter.
In other words, do we say that when it comes to the flesh, humans and animals share the same flesh? It's just that the human being has a mind, a consciousness, etc. That's the only difference. Or do we say that no? Because a human being has those qualities of intelligence and consciousness and all that stuff, therefore even the flesh is transformed. And there's a distinction even in those areas that otherwise seem similar. So that's the debate. Korach would say, humans and donkeys, the same in flesh. Moshe would say, 100% different. Make sense? So it turns out that the question of science versus Torah, three kingdoms or four, is it inanimate or mineral life, vegetation, animal, and that's it? Or do we add human being as a separate category? It goes back to this core debate. Is the human being just an animal with intelligence, so might as well call it an animal as well? Or does the intelligence and the soul, does that fundamentally shift even the physical properties of the human being to render the human being in a category unto its own? So now we have to answer the final question, and that is, so it seems like a very interesting debate, a very core, essential debate that comes up in many different areas when it comes to blackberries, and when it comes to leaders, and when it comes to animals and human beings. But why does it touch on heresy? Oh, by the way, I should mention. Remember the Talmud says that Korach asked about a talit prayer shawl that's all blue? Do you need the fringes? Or a house that's filled with books or scrolls? Do you need a mezuzah? Or a skin that's filled with the white stuff, the white patches? Is it pure or not pure? It's the same idea. You see, Korach looked at the mitzvah as the extension, it's going to be hard to say this quickly, but the bottom line is, Korach said, if a house is filled with scrolls, you gain nothing by putting a mezuzah. Well, what's a mezuzah? It's an additional scroll. Who needs the additional scroll? Fundamentally, it's the same. It's the scrolls are already there, so why do you need the extra scroll on the doorpost? It's superfluous. It's like Moshe's quality as being a prophet. Fine, it's like an add-on, but it doesn't affect the core. The core is that this is a house that's filled with holy books. And Moshe says, no, that little feature, that little camera changes everything. That's the mitzvah. And that fundamentally makes it whether it's a room that's kosher or a room that's not so kosher. In other words, the little scroll that could makes a big difference. It's not just a little scroll, but the whole house is filled. Everyone's holy. We're all equivalent. It's not so. Okay, let's move from there and address the final point. And that is, why does this touch on heresy? So in order to understand this, we need to know what Plato says. And to know what Plato says, we're going to look at the Ragachover, text 13. David.
In truth, Korach's position is the same heresy as the well-known heresy of Plato. Plato says that when it comes to animal life, both humans and beasts are equal. When it comes to plant life, that is, the phenomena of growth, man, animal, and plant are equal. And in experience of inanimate matter, everything is equal. Thus, the higher creations are merely successive additions to the lower ones. Inanimate matter that grows is that grows as a plant that can also move as an animal that can think as a man. In other words, Plato maintains that men deprived of their intellects are equal with one another and indistinguishable from animals. This runs contrary to the entire Torah, which is why Korach is called a heretic in the Jerusalem Talmud.
According to Plato, how many categories are there in life?
One.
It's all the same. At the core, it's all the same. We're all equal. It's all inanimate matter. It's just, this is inanimate matter, plus growth, plus movement, plus intelligence. But at the core, it's the same. By the way, and this may be not a wise thing to mention, I'm going to mention it anyway. Remember Harambe, help me out here. What was the monkey's name, the gorilla's name? Harambe. They shot the monkey. The kid went in there. They shot the monkey. Or the gorilla. What was it? Remember in the zoo? The kid snuck in and they killed the... Yes? Happened like a few years ago.
Which zoo?
Harambe. No. No, it was like in St. Louis.
Midwest.
Remember this?
Yes.
Oh, come on, guys.
They shot them.
The gorilla, whatever it was. I call everything monkey.
Who shot the gorilla?
Huh? They should have shot the... Oh, so that's what people...
They should have shot the parents.
Well, that's the thing. So there was a big debate. Big debate that followed.
To save the kid.
The kid wandered. The kid snuck down through the thing. Down into the habitat, whatever they call it. Right? And then the gorilla was playing with the kid. And they were fearing for the kid's life. So they shot the... Then the question was, should they shot the parents?
When the kid shot
them?
No, of course not. No.
I didn't do it either. I know, but I thought maybe that's what you thought.
And I take no responsibility for anything that happened at that zoo. I was not there, not involved. Okay, so the point is that afterwards... Many, there was a big discussion on social media and in the media and on the radio and the TV, everywhere. The question is, what should have happened? Did they do the right thing? Did the zoo do the right thing? Did they not do the right thing? Yeah. The question is like this. A child, a young child, a two-year-old child, a three-year-old child, the same as a gorilla or different? That's the question. That's the core question. It all goes back to this. This is just one example. Mike, you're shaking your head. Sorry. I thought you were disagreeing. Okay. The core question is this. Is because if the child doesn't have intelligence, so who's to say that they killed the right entity? I'm not suggesting this. I'm saying others suggested this. Right? Maybe the gorilla was smarter than the child. Yeah, maybe the child will grow up to be a smart, but who knows? No one knows. No one knows what's going to happen to the kid. But at this point in time, how can you take the life of the gorilla? How can you take the animal life? Isn't the child just another animal with potential for something? But who says that one life is greater than the other? That's a Platonic, I don't know what you call it. It's a Plato perspective. That's a Korach perspective, as the Rogachev says. The Rogachev draws an equivalency between Korach and Plato in this idea that life at the core, life between all various classifications, he says, is the same. Just this as this feature, that addition, but at the core, everything is the same. Kulam kedoshim, everyone's holy. So why do you make yourselves so superior? Why do you elevate yourselves above the people? Everyone's the same. There's no difference. An animal is a more sophisticated plant, and a plant is a more sophisticated earth piece, right? And a human being is a more sophisticated animal, but not fundamentally different. If that's the case, so number one, it gets into issues of the value of human life, which I mentioned. But in addition to that, it gets back to something else that's very fundamental. And this is where the heresy comes in. Maimonides explains, and I'm going to paraphrase this and we'll close it out. Maimonides explains in his Guide for the Perplexed, text 14a and 14b, very, very long texts, brilliant texts. Your homework is to read both and to understand it. That's your homework. What Maimonides says in short is that whereas Judaism believes that God created all life, something from nothing, which is something that we discussed at length in the recent JLI course, God created everything, yesh ma'ayin, something from nothing. Other philosophers, including Plato, other philosophers believe that matter always existed. Exists alongside God. How that works, I'll leave it up to them to decide and figure out. But as Maimonides says, and he studied Plato extensively, that matter or the substance of existence exists alongside God, so to speak. Maybe God originally formed it, whatever it is, but that stuff exists. And from that, everything unfolds. So therefore, everything is evolutionary. Everything is evolving from the same stuff. So it starts off inanimate, and then it grows, and then it moves, and then it thinks, but at the core, it's all the same. He says, Maimonides says, that is a departure from the fundamental Jewish belief that God created everything from in the manner of something from nothing, which means that God granted each thing its individual identity and life. So God created the mineral as a mineral, and God created the vegetable as a vegetable, and God created the animal as an animal, and God created the human being as a human being. Even though Kabbalah also speaks about somewhat of an evolutionary process, which is true on some level, but at the core, Judaism believes that God created everything from nothing, which means that everything is granted its own place. And everything has its own sandbox to play in. This is a different opinion than Korach. It's a different opinion than Plato. And it provides for us, in the final analysis, it provides for us an inspiring lesson about life. There was once a young girl who asked her mother, "Where do we come from?" And the mother said, "We come from God." And the girl says, "That's funny, because I asked Dad the same question. And he said, we come from the apes." So the mother says, "Well, he was talking about his side of the family, I'm talking about mine." Right? So the question is like this. Are we just more evolved Earth? Or do we have a divine quality, a unique divine quality as human beings that also affects the earthliness of us? That's the question. Everyone agrees that the human being has superior qualities. The question is, in the stuff, in the parts of us that seem the same to other areas of life, do we have fundamental distinctions? The Hasidic answer, the Kabbalistic answer, the Jewish answer is yes. And therefore, in the final analysis, this gives us a charge to not just eat and drink and nurture and protect and shelter and rest like every other creature that does that, but do so in a way that bespeaks our essential quality and essential holiness. We'll conclude with text number 15. Who just, Lali, did you just read?
No.
Lali, we're up to you. Text number 15.
Are agents of the Rebbe. If the Hasid actively discharges his mission, he is bound up with his Rebbe, bound up in his entire being. There walks a Hasid, there eats a Hasid, and there sleeps a Hasid.
In the Yiddish it works better. The turn of phrase here is weird. There eats a chassid. No one's eating a chassid. It's not. But there a chassid is eating. In other words, when you're living the life of a chassid, and it's not only about. This is the context that it was taught in. But the point is, when you're living a noble life, then even when you're eating, you're a mensch. Even when you're sleeping, you're a mensch. And even when you're walking, you're a mensch. I know I went out of order. Even when you walk down the street, it's not just an animal lumbering on its way. You know, it's a human being. It's a chassid. It's a mensch. When you're eating, it's a chassid. When you're sleeping, even when you're sleeping, you're not so aware. It's still different. Animals also sleep, right? And yet there's a distinction. So in the final analysis, the charge for today is, let's recognize that even in the mundane areas, we have the ability to live a more noble, higher, soulful existence Let's maximize our potential and indeed make a difference even in those areas that appear to be low. Thank you very much for joining me tonight for Torah Studies.